Thank you for having me. I think he raises some impressive questions, and I think it's important to deal with them. My talk here is sort of to talk to you a little bit about why I did what I did. But to address a little bit of what Professor Mesrouy is saying, I think that we live in a different world here. I think we're sheltered by having really not a sense of what it's like to walk down the street and have a cop throw you up against the wall when you're not doing anything wrong. And even if you are doing something wrong, you still deserve to be free to walk down the street and not have a cop throw you up against the wall. In the world of Bed-Stuy, in the world of East Flatbush, that's the type of world in which Americans live. Professor Mesrouy and I were talking, he just got back from a trip from Africa, and people there were asking about why there's so many shootings in the United States. Why do we have so much gang violence? We hear so much about this stuff, and yet we don't have a sense of what it's like to live there. And it's easy for us to simply say that these guys are bad, they deserve to have whatever happens to them. But it's hard to say that when you don't appreciate what it's like to live in those places. I started out with a sense of simply thinking that if you're caught with drugs, if you have something bad on you, or if you've done something wrong, you deserve to be punished, right? That was just my sense of it. That's how I thought about what was right and what was wrong. And as I've been doing this for the past 2 years at Legal Aid, I feel completely different. I feel absolutely different. Day in and day out, you have race issues, you have class issues that I never thought existed before until I came to Brooklyn. I brought my girlfriend Jen to arraignments one night. Arraignments are where you meet your client for the first time, and you slide your card underneath the pens, and it's really, really smelly back there, and there are like 30, 40 people. It's terrible, terrible conditions. You introduce yourself, and you tell them what they're being charged with, and you go from there. And Jen got to see, for the first time, what people get arrested for, all right? People are getting arrested for riding bicycles on a sidewalk. Riding bicycles on a sidewalk. I grew up in Northern Virginia. I went to West Springfield High School. I rode my bicycle on the sidewalk. Why do they arrest people who are riding their bicycles on the sidewalk? Why would you guess? Why do we have a rule in New York City that says you can't ride your bicycle on the sidewalk? Okay, poor people, everyone rides bicycles, though, right? I mean, why do they stop people who ride bicycles on the sidewalk? They can pick them up for something heavier. It allows them to have a right, right? What do you mean, a right? All right, so they create this rule that says no riding bicycles on a sidewalk, okay? Can't ride a bicycle on a sidewalk. They pull you over. You're just hanging out with your buddies. They pull you, throw you up against the wall, search you. You may have some weed on you. You may have a gun. But the bottom line is, a lot of these guys who get pulled over don't have weed on them, don't have a gun. And what happens is, they sit in the system for a couple days, they start getting arrests, they start getting violations, which is the next sort of level up, and criminal records, jobs, schooling, it all becomes a downhill battle. People get arrested for sitting on the subways, taking up two seats now. It's a new rule. You cannot sit on the subway in New York City and take up two seats. People get processed day in and day out. When Rudy Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani's in the news right now, he did a great job of cleaning up crime. How did he do it? All the graffiti guys, all the guys who were just asking for money, he created these rules that said, let's pick them up, let's put them in jail. Those guys, some of them were also committing some more serious things, and it actually turned out pretty well. But you know what? I'll tell you this much. If I grew up in Brooklyn, I'd be fed up with it. I'd be fed up with it. So it was in that context that I sort of felt empowered to do something. I started out like you guys. How many of you are first years, by the way? I have no sense. What's your first years? Second years? A few? And then 3 years? Wow. You're great, children. Okay, that's great. I, like you, started off not knowing what I wanted to do with my life. I sort of came to law school with a very noble sense of what it is to practice law. And when I came here, I didn't really know what the options were. When I got here, it was pretty clear what the law school sort of focuses on, and it's law firms. And You see it in the Hunt Williams hallway. You see it in the softball tournaments with all the names of all the law firms. You see it with the cocktails and the interview rooms. And when you get here, they say nothing, but you see law firms. And I got caught up. You know, I got caught up in it too. It's amazing. I think what's, Jörg and I, when I came down last year to talk on the panel, we were talking about, I'll get to some of the costs and benefits of what it's like being a public defender, but one of the things we talked about was the money, you know, and I think I wrote on the board, I wrote down $140,000. That was the starting salary then. It's actually $160,000 now. $160,000 for your first year. And then I erased the one, and I said, that's the cost. That's the cost of being a public defender. But I think it's important what Jörg is doing by doing this. I think that you deserve a lot of credit for focusing on, and Professor Mizrui and Professor Coughlin, who just left, I think you guys focused on some really good things in considering other options. So the basic reason I'm down here is to convey to you guys that it is important to consider other options, especially in light of two real important and interesting realities. The first reality is this. The 2006 employment statistics at UVA Law School, I printed them off the Career Center a few days ago. As of the fall 2006, right, we gave 375 JDs to people last year. Of those 375 people, 249 went to law firms, 77%. Okay, right off the bat, straight to law firms. Next largest group, what do you think the next largest group was? Clerkships, 60 people, 16%. How many of those clerks then go on to law firms? A lot, all right? Probably most, okay? About 90% of people at UVA, one of the top 10 law schools in the country, go to law firms. Okay, that's fact number one, all right? Fact number two, we're doing some research online to see, you know, what are the sort of the law firm retention rates, all right? 60 to 70% of associates who work at law firms leave by their fourth year. 60 to 70% leave by the fourth year. We have 90% of our school going to these jobs where they don't stick around that long. Why? A number of reasons, and we'll talk about them a little bit. But the bottom line is that they're not giving us a sense of worth. They're not giving us a sense of value that I think a lot of us sort of thought about when we decided to go to law school. The first years especially, I don't know how many of you remember what you wrote in your essays when you applied. I imagine you guys remember better than most, but I don't think any of you wrote about going to work at a law firm and making a lot of money. I don't think you wrote to UVA, and Courtney is going to probably start reading some of these essays now. I doubt that anyone is writing essays about making a lot of money. I think they're writing essays about helping people, about doing something good with your JD. And so the macro sort of purpose of my talk here, and I think Jörg and I have been talking a lot about this, is to expose you guys to some other options. This talk is centered around being a public defender because, you know, I think they say you write what you know, I'll speak what I know, but this includes being an assistant district attorney at the state level. This includes being an AUSA, federal prosecutor. This includes being a federal public defender, all right? 1.3% of people last year went into public interest, 5 people, all right? I disagree a little bit with what we define as public interest. I would say that the military, you could argue, is public interest. There were 7 people, which is pretty surprising, actually. And then federal and state and local governments, 3.2%. So I think that it's about 5 or 6% of our class did something public interest related. All right? And I'm here to tell you that there is something very powerful about doing something public interest. All right? I'm a guy who kind of did it both ways. All right? I graduated UVA. I went to Aiken. I went to Aiken Gump for 2 years. And I was a corporate lawyer. A lot of you guys are going to go do this. You're going to go be a corporate lawyer. You're going to work on big transactions. You're going to do a lot of due diligence. You're going to do some interesting things and some not so interesting things. And after about 2 years of doing it, I felt like I wasn't practicing law in the way that I had envisioned it. A lot of how I envisioned it had to do with my experience growing up. I was born in Peru. My father worked for the United States Agency for International Development, and I also lived in Haiti for 4 years. I lived in Haiti during Baby Doc Duvalier's regime, and so I saw what it was like to live in an environment where people didn't really have any rights, where everyone was really, really poor, and I thought, wow, it'd be kind of cool to be able to do something with my law degree that focused on helping these people. So I decided to become a public defender at Legal Aid, and what I do day to day is really a lot of what we've just talked about. I fight for the rights of my clients. I defend the Constitution in a certain respect. What I don't do is get people off. People think, oh, you're a public defender, you get people off. I don't get people off, all right? The cop gets on the stand and testifies and lies about how he finds the drugs on my client. And I simply say, well, wait, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, this doesn't make any sense. And the jury decides to acquit him. I didn't get him off. The prosecutor didn't satisfy his burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This notion that, like, I somehow just get my guys off is not the goal. The number one goal is to make sure that all the rights that we're all entitled to, they get too. All right? When you get accused of a crime, I don't know how many of you know someone who's been accused of a crime. Maybe, God forbid, you guys have been accused of a crime. I don't know how many of you feel about that, but it is a very, very hard thing to deal with. It's a very hard thing to deal with, being accused of a crime, being arrested, put in jail, and all that kind of stuff. And we simply, I think society really likes to write off people who aren't considered, I think we don't give them the benefit of the doubt, all right? And so when people say, you're a public defender, you must get a lot of people off, I totally disagree with that, all right? On the micro level, I defend poor people who are accused of crimes, all right? Some of them have done something wrong. On the macro level, I defend these rights that we're all talking about. The right to counsel, you know. A guy gets arrested for a burglary or a robbery. Detectives pick him up from his house, bring him over to the police station. He doesn't have an attorney at this point, okay? If the guy's smart enough, or if he's had me in the past, I've been his legal aid in the past, he'll pull out his card and say, I want my lawyer. Someone from the detective's office will call me up at legal aid. I'll go down to do the lineup. In that lineup, there'll be six people. My guy's black, 6 feet tall, with a beard. The description that the complaining witness gave to the detectives, it's my guy. The other five people don't look anything like my guy. I go in there and I'm like, well, wait a second here, we can't put you in the lineup. It says, we might as well just have you stand there in seat number three and just have no one else answer. They come in, they go through the window and they go, number three. They might as well just do that because they like to exploit, and I don't judge them. I don't judge them for that. I think it's a crucial thing to have police officers. I think it's a crucial thing to have prosecutors. I think it's important to have these things. I don't judge them. I simply say, do it right. Do it right. I was talking to Professor Kaufman right before she left, and I was telling her how it's an interesting time for me in my life. It's an interesting time for me, a time for you guys in your own lives. It's your first year, you're deciding what you're going to do this summer and considering the different options. It's an interesting time for me because on Tuesday, 5 days from now, I'm about to start my first felony trial ever. I've done two jury trials that were misdemeanors, all right? There's two types of courts in New York. There's the criminal court, criminal court where misdemeanors happen. You get a jury on a misdemeanor only where you're punished up to 6 months or more in jail. If it's under that, you just get a bench trial in front of a judge. And most of these judges are typically former prosecutors. I joke and I say that a bench trial is a slow allocution. An allocution is where a guy pleads guilty. Being in front of a judge trying a bench trial, unless you have some really good legal issue to hang your hat on, if they're just going to decide facts and what is reasonable doubt based on facts, telling you right now, they're probably going to find you got guilty. So it's tough. So I've done two misdemeanor jury trials. And on Tuesday, I'm about to start my first felony trial. My client, Mr. Smith, is looking at minimum 3.5 years in jail, maximum 9 years in jail. Trial starts Tuesday. All right? Drug cases, it's a Criminal possession of a controlled substance in the fourth degree. It's a Class C felony. He's charged with having a quarter ounce of crack. I don't know if any of you know what that looks like, but that's about a circle. And I'm not here to discuss whether you agree or not with the drug laws. It's a serious crime to have that much crack, and it's scary. It's scary in a certain way that I'm here talking to you guys about doing this, and yet 5 days from now I'm about to go try this case. What's interesting about this case is that it has been tried already. A senior attorney at Legal Aid tried this case 2 weeks ago and got a hung jury. 9 wanted to acquit him, 3 wanted to convict him. And once that senior attorney got the hung jury, I'm one of the new eager guys. I'm like, listen, I went to my boss and said, let me try this case. So it's in Supreme Court. So you've got the criminal court. This is in Supreme Court. The 12 jurors, all right? Supreme Court of New York is not the highest. Then they have the appellate court, which is above it. So it's an interesting time for me to be here because I am sort of about to do something that is very, very extreme. I'm about to defend a guy with not too much experience. I've got 2 jury trials. I've got a bench trial. I've got a bunch of hearings that I've won that never actually ended up on the track. But I'm about to do something really, really extreme. Let me tell you a little bit about the story, because I think it's cool to hear what your thoughts are about it. There were 2 cops on foot patrol. The only reason I'm talking about it is because I've been thinking about it day in and day out. I woke up last couple nights, been writing notes down, and I'm so involved in this right now that I think it's cool to be able to talk to you about it and tell you a little bit about what I do, what you could be doing if you decide to either do this after you leave UVA or after you leave the law firm after a couple of years. The chances are, whether they say 60-70% of the people are going to leave, they're going to look for something else to do. Alright? A lot of people, you know, it's funny, a lot of people come back, you know, Courtney came back, Yeri came back. This is an amazing place. You know, so if you can find something to do here too, that would be awesome as well. 2 cops are on foot patrol. It's a daytime, it's October 10th, it's 2006. Unidentified elderly woman comes up to them and says, this drug's being sold at the corner. Okay? One of the guys goes up, walks up to the corner. As he's walking up to the corner, he sees a hand-to-hand exchange. Hand-to-hand is code for selling drugs, right? Cops use, very often they'll have phrases, right? Hand-to-hand is code for, you know, there's a drug deal going down. Cop comes up. One guy walks one way. The other guy walks the other. It's just that cop. Cop doesn't radio the other cop to come. The cop just sees one guy walk one way, one guy walk the other way. He doesn't yell for that guy to stop. He doesn't say, hey, come back, you know. He just walks up to Mr. Smith, it's my client. Goes up to him and says, hey, what are you doing here? Mr. Smith is like, I'm here seeing some friends. And he goes, oh yeah, you got any ID on you? And Mr. Smith goes, no. That's what the cop says. The cop says, no. He said, no ID. Although, once they do the search on him, search incident to a lawful arrest, they find ID on him, okay? Then he asks him, do you have any weapons? Do you have any contraband on you? And at that point, the cop testifies in the first trial that Mr. Smith takes off his hat and says, yes, officer, I have crack in my hat. And that's the story. This guy's looking at minimum 3.5 years, maximum 9 years. And their story is, yes, officer, here's some crack in my hat. We laugh, right? We laugh, all right? It sounds like a joke. It sounds like a joke. It's not a joke to Mr. Smith. He tried this case already, all right? He got a hung jury. The DA offered 5 years probation to be done with the case, and he said no. No? How would you not? I'm a risk-averse guy, all right? How would you not take 5 years probation versus minimum 3.5, maximum 9? And the judge will probably hit him with closer to 9. The judge has... Drug cases are determinate sentences as opposed to indeterminate. Indeterminate means you do 15 to life, right? 15-2 means indeterminate. Drug cases are 6.5, 7, 4, all right? So you can get anywhere in between. He says, no way, I'm not taking it. I said, why? He goes, I didn't do it. I'm like, you're willing to sit in upstate jail for a principal? And he said, yeah, I'm willing to do it. I mean, he's also been emboldened by the fact that this jury has questioned it just like you guys and laughed when they heard the story. But it's a powerful, powerful world in which Mr. Smith lives. Here's the way he said it went down. And I'm not sure I believe the way he said it went down either. He said he was coming out of the cleaners. And the cop came up to him, and these cops like to shake down people to take their money. Some do. Some cops are totally shady. A lot of them are completely honest. And this cop comes up to him and says, you got some crack on you. And he pulls it out of his own pocket, the cop says. Right? And he takes, Mr. Smith had $2,700 on him. All right? The jury's never going to hear anything about that. Why? Because it's less probative than prejudicial. You know that whole standard, is it prejudicial, is it probative? They're never going to hear about the money because he's not being charged with sale. He's just being charged with possession. If the jury heard that he had $2,700 on him, they may say, wow, he was up to no good. So the law has some protections there, right? They say that, you know, some things can't come in. His story is that this cop shook him down. All right? My story to the jurors, you know, first of all, you're dealing with Brooklyn jurors. You're not dealing with Charlottesville jurors, you know. Brooklyn jurors distrust police. Brooklyn jurors know what it's like to be riding a bicycle on the sidewalk. Brooklyn jurors knows what it's like to see a drug deal go down. And Brooklyn jurors, I hope for Mr. Smith, buy this argument that their story is BS, that could have been this other guy's, you know. What kind of guy lies about having his ID on him? Anyone in Brooklyn knows if you lie about your ID, or if you don't have ID, a cop is going to arrest you. All right? What kind of guy lies about having his ID on him, but then says, oh, you know what, officer, you're right. Big crack in my back. The DA's going to sell it, very basically, right? How's he going to sell it? He's going to say, it's like a kid getting caught, you know. He lied about the ID because he didn't want to know who he was, and then he saw he was just stuck, and he said, you know what, I give up. Here it is. Decent sell, too. You know, I'm not exactly sure how it went down. Mr. Smith tells it to me one way, but it's a decent sell, too. And I'm scared. I am scared for Mr. Smith. All right? I've got a lot of good things. The two cops who testify, a lot of good inconsistencies. But I'm a little scared. What I do know is this. Deep down inside, I know the way that the cops said it went down is not the way that it actually did go down. All right? And that's what gives me this sort of feeling of doing something noble and doing something good, because it really feels powerful to go in there and to convince 12 jurors and 3 alternates that the story of, yes, officer, I cracked my hat, is BS. You know, and it's a really important thing for a guy like Mr. Smith to have a public defender like me who sits here and really stresses out about it, obsesses about it, and really is focused on just wanting to do this right. Because if I were in Mr. Smith's shoes, I'd want a public defender like me as well. Let's talk about the cost associated with what I do. I mean, the big thing is the money, right? We talk about the money, and I think it's a very appealing thing to be able to go make $160,000 a year. There is a bright side to it. I think the UVA Loan Forgiveness Program is extremely important. I get $15,000 a year from UVA. I make around 50 or so, 50 to 60, and UVA gives me $15,000 a year to go be a public defender. Not close to 160, but it does give you some leeway in what you do. What are the benefits about going to be a public defender? You know, I didn't know what the benefits were going to be either until I actually did it. I think the biggest benefit, you hear, those of you who are first years haven't heard sort of the catchphrases that law firms are going to use to say, hey, come to our law firm. Let's give you early responsibility, is the phrase that a lot of law firms give you. We're going to give you early responsibility. Most of the guys that I know who are still in law firms who are litigators have not walked into a courtroom yet. I've still been sitting behind the desk, doing some interesting stuff, doing some not so interesting stuff, but don't get the experience that I think you can get by being a public defender. As I told you, I've done 2 jury trials, I've done a bench trial. I'm starting to learn a craft. I'm starting to get a sense of what it's like to be a trial lawyer. And that is a really, really interesting thing. Those 2 years that I was a corporate lawyer at Aiken, I didn't feel like I was really practicing law. I didn't feel like I was learning a real craft. I mean, I was understanding some things. I was writing, drafting some agreements and things like that. But I didn't feel like I was really understanding the craft. And I think more important than that, I didn't feel like I was helping people. And I felt that that was something that was missing in my life. And I didn't realize coming into UVA that that was going to be important to me as well. to help people until I start doing this thing that we call being a public defender. The benefits are easy to see. You get a lot of experience. You learn a difficult and unique craft. It's a greater quality of life. I mean, I think a big reason why people come down to UVA to work after law school is because it's a great life. You know, I see Jason in the back. I mean, you guys have a great life down here. It's rewarding. It's satisfying. You help people. I mean, imagine having that and also practicing law. Imagine having that, practicing law, doing something good, and also having power in front of a jury. I mean, there is a huge ego component to it. You know, you can't deny that. You know, you can't deny that being in front of a jury is a huge, huge ego component. If you're not confident, if you're not willing to sell yourself, your client's going to lose. You know, so there's a lot of cool things that this job combines. We're all going to struggle in life, I think, to find the thing that makes us happy. My struggle took 2 years, and then I decided that, I found it. I got lucky, and I found it early. So I think that is important to understand, that there's some really, really huge benefits to it. The big cost is the money. And we could talk here for a long time about values and consumption and what, you know, where you fall on the spectrum, but consider it as an option, because it is extremely, extremely worthwhile. So we were talking before about what I actually do and what I don't do. You know, the micro level, I defend poor people who are accused of crimes. At the macro level, I defend these rights. That's probably the most interesting way to describe it. All right, that's probably the biggest thing I do. The second biggest thing I do is I mitigate damages. I plea bargain a lot of cases. A lot of the guys that I defend have done something wrong or haven't, but they want to get done with their case. Brooklyn is an interesting community because you have the most crime in all five boroughs. So as a result, when you get a case, chances are it's not going to go to trial. Why is it that in Brooklyn, most of the cases never go to trial? Why do they make such good offers in Brooklyn? Why do you think? No time in the courts, right? It's filled up. Prisons are jam-packed, all right? So a lot of what I do is I take a guy who's gotten in trouble, and I say, how do I help him the best that I can? One of the ways is I look at the complaint, and I say, wait a second, they're charging him with all these elements and or all these crimes, and they can't make this out. They can't do this. So we get some of the charges dismissed. I talk to the DA, and I say, listen, let's make it less community service. Let's get him into a program. Let's do something here to help out my guy. Is it appealing to you to help out those types of people? I don't know. To me it is. To me it is appealing, and it's super important. I'll tell you why. Because I feel lucky. I feel lucky having been given what I've been given. You know, growing up mostly in Northern Virginia, going to good schools and all that kind of stuff. And I feel lucky. I think had it been different, had we all been born in Brooklyn and Bed-Stuy, I think we'd be singing a different tune. And so, in a certain way, I identify with a lot of these people who do get in trouble. I don't break any laws, but I guarantee you some of your friends that you know in college had weed on them or did something heavier. I guarantee you some of the friends you know drive drunk or drive with a suspension on their license. You don't do the heavier stuff. You don't do violence, hopefully, and things like that. Beat your wife. But we're all entitled to it, you know. Why does it matter to defend these people who have done something wrong? I guess you could say, well, listen, I don't do anything wrong, so it really doesn't matter to me. I'd say it does. I don't know how many of you have been up to New York recently, but post 9/11, they now search your bags randomly in certain subway stations. Certain subway stations during random hours have cops sit there with a table, and they randomly select someone to look into their bags. I don't know about you, but I don't want someone looking in my bag. All right, that's just the first sort of taste of what it's like in the mainstream world to see what it's like to live in an area in which I work. I mean, these guys deal with it day in and day out. They get searched, they get harassed, and things like that. So I think it does matter. I think it does matter. The Patriot Act, we talk a lot about sort of things that are happening there with wiretapping and things like that. I think it does matter, and I think it does impact us in a way that in a way that I think you may be motivated to do this.
Truth,
the notion of truth and what is truth plays no role in what I do. Truth plays no role in being a public defender. Truth plays a role in what Yared does as a prosecutor. It should, right? If there's no truth to the case, a prosecutor's duty is to not try the case. But if my guy has committed the crime or not committed the crime, I don't really care, right? I gotta defend the guy to the best of my abilities. One of my roommates, I live with my older brother and his roommate from college, one of my roommates is an ER physician. And he worked at Jacoby Montefiore in the Bronx. It's the largest hospital system in New York. And day in and day out, he was having two people being carted in. It was the rapist and the victim of the rape. The shooter and the victim of the shooter. And he just got his stuff out and he just started sewing up and he just started fixing everyone. In the same way that he kind of does that kind of stuff, I too do that. I go into Brooklyn, people are accused of crimes, and I try to help them. I try to sew it up. I try to get the best deals I can. Occasionally, I try the cases. And when I try the cases, that's when you really get this sense of purpose, of meaning, of doing something that is greater than yourself. And I never felt that before. I mean, some of you are going to love being at law firms. All right? Some of you will actually love being at law firms. All right? Teach his own. Some people really, really love it. But I'm telling you, chances are you're not going to love it. It's going to be okay. And you're going to look for something else. If you're looking for something else that gives you meaning, if you're looking for something else that's super interesting, if you're looking for something that transcends just yourself and your own purpose and your own self-worth, consider a job like this. Consider being a public defender. Consider being a prosecutor. Consider doing something that is more than just about us. All right? It's hard, right? We have loans. I walked out of school with $130,000, I think, or 20. I think it's like a lot more now. I'm sure it's a lot more now. You know, it's hard. It's hard to pass up the 160. But being here and telling you a little bit about what it's like, I hope gives you at least some sense that there are other cool things out there. So what do I do day to day? I pick up cases and arraignments 3 times a month. It's either night arraignments or day arraignments. And I go in and I introduce myself and I pick up maybe 20 cases a day. Of those 20 cases, maybe 15 will be pled out that day. What type of cases do I pick up? I wrote a list. Let me just read you things so you can hear what I do. This is what I've done the last 2 years. So I do violations, misdemeanors, and now felonies. I've been here for about 2 years, so I'm doing some heavier stuff. Weapons, anything and everything. I picked up guns, I picked up knives, I picked up samurai swords. I had a client who had a samurai sword, and he tried to slash someone. Unbelievable. Drugs, anything and everything. Possession, sale is a big one. Possession, your first arrest. In Brooklyn, you have crack on you. Let's use a different example. Your first arrest
in Brooklyn, you have
heroin on you. What do you think the punishment is? Probation? Who else? Anyone think you get any jail time? You think you get jail time? Yeah, I mean, they've repealed those, but just in general, what's your general sense? You get caught with a little bag of heroin. How much? Okay. All interesting perspectives. Your first arrest in Brooklyn, you have a little bit of heroin on you, which is misdemeanor weight, not felony weight. You get what's called an ACD, adjournment in contemplation of dismissal. Stay out of trouble for 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, your case is going to be dismissed and sealed. On top of that, you have to do a 2-day program called TIP, the Treatment Intervention Program. You watch TV for 2 hours each afternoon about why drugs are bad. That's your punishment for having one bag of heroin. I have been a public defender for 2 years. I have signed up 5 guys for probation. I hate probation. Probation is one of those things where you have a guy watching you the whole time, and a lot of people get arrested in Brooklyn, right? If you're walking down the street and you're getting pulled over, if you're doing bad stuff and not doing bad stuff, one of the conditions of probation is that you don't get rearrested. And if you get rearrested, they're going to give you a lot of time, so I really try to stay away from that. ACD and TIP for your first arrest on that heroin. You get arrested again, the same heroin. What's your punishment now? A violation. Disorderly conduct. Not even a misdemeanor yet. A violation. So you still don't have a criminal record. A violation right below misdemeanors. No criminal record yet. It's amazing, right? It's shocking, all right? That same bag of heroin on your first arrest, you pick up here in Charlottesville. Well, I actually don't know the laws in Charlottesville. That same bag of heroin, you pick up in Nassau County. You know where Nassau County is? That Long Island area right there? What's your sentence there? A B misdemeanor, so it gives you a criminal record, or an A misdemeanor, and 30 days jail. Same bag, same everything. It's really, really interesting because Brooklyn, you're spoiled in a certain way as a public defender, right? There's so much crime, there's so much going on that day to day, you're pleading out almost everything. You are pleading out almost everything. Rarely, on the less serious stuff, do you have a guy go to jail. On the more serious stuff, assaults, you do a lot of assault. You do a lot of regular, just two guys fighting, a lot of domestic violence, prostitution, theft, petty larceny, grand larceny. Larceny is you see a lot of homeless people, or people who are drug addicts going to like CVS and they take bar soda and they get arrested and they go to jail for a little bit on that. Criminal mischief, destruction of property, animal cruelty is a big one. A lot of people are getting charged now. I don't know if it's the Michael Vick thing, but I think it even was before Michael Vick. People are going to jail for a long time for doing bad things to their pets. It's terrible. I mean, it's a terrible case. A lot of people at legal aid do not like handling those types of cases because they're just really terrible. A lot of forgery, a lot of white collar stuff. You'd be surprised. There are a lot of people in Brooklyn who actually do some white collar things as well. Witness tampering. A client is charged with a crime. He'll go out and he'll tell that witness, "You better not testify against me." That's a separate charge in and of itself. A lot of driving offenses, DWI, driving without a license, driving with a suspended license. Robbery, burglary, criminal contempt. Criminal contempt, does anyone know what that means? If I am charged with beating up my girlfriend and I get arrested, the court is going to issue what's called an order of protection, which means I can't have any contact with her. Full stay away order. I can't call her, I can't email her, I can't text, I can't see her. If I have any contact with her and she calls the police, criminal contempt is a charge. You're violating a court order. Sex, abuse, rape are the big ones. Molestation, you do a lot of that. Stalking, harassment, resisting arrest, we also do a lot of as well. Because a lot of these cases are about these police who oftentimes step over the boundary. When I was in arraignments one night, I was talking to one of the police officers who works there. He was on the beat, the street, for 10 years, and he decided that it's really unsafe to do what he does. And so he decided to look in the criminal courthouse. And it's very, very safe in the criminal courthouse, and that's what he does now. And I was talking to him one night after I was in front of a judge, and I was arguing, "Judge, this is a weak case." I was arguing, you're doing your bail argument, right? You know, once you meet your guy in arraignments, you give him the card, you talk about the case, some of them get pled out. And if they don't get pled out, what happens is the DA then says, "Judge, we're asking for bail in the amount of $10,000. Everyone knows what bail is? Bail is a mechanism that ensures that your guy is going to turn up in court again, right? For most of these people with no money, even setting $250 bail, what's they do? Means that your guy just stays in jail. Okay, no one can afford bail in Brooklyn. So when bail is set, typically, you're staying in jail. But in general, down here or somewhere else, bail is set, you're going to pay it, you're going to get out. It's an incentive not to flee, all right? We're arguing about bail that night, and I'm saying, "Judge, one of the issues here, it's a weak case." The judge is talking to me, I'm talking to him, I'm like, "Judge, they said they witnessed him put it in his pocket, but they were down the street when the crime occurred. How could they have seen him put it in the pocket?" So your argument, the cop pulls me up, the guy who was on the beat for 10 years, and he turns to me after the case is done, bail was set on the guy, and he said, "You know how many of our arrests have some probable cause issue with them?" I said, "I don't know, that's an interesting question. How many of the arrests have some probable cause issue?" Meaning he didn't have a right to stop. 75 to 80% of the cases. Does a cop not have the legal right? The legal right, Professor Mizrui teaches criminal procedure. Professor Coughlin teaches it. You talk about a lot of things, the right to stop, searches, seizures, right to counsel. The stuff we learn in law school doesn't really exist in the world in which I work. And so the job that I try to do is I try to take what I learned in law school and I try to apply it to that world. And occasionally, the law triumphs. I had a guy who was caught walking into a subway with a machete. Big machete. Alright? He was on parole. He was on lifetime parole. They arrested him, they put him in the car, into the police car, and then they opened up the bag and they searched him and they found the machete. And I'm looking through case law and I'm saying, well, wait a second here, there's gotta be some way out of this, alright? You can't just go into a guy's bag, can you? Maybe you can, but you normally need a search warrant for that, right? What are the exceptions to the search warrant, right? There are all sorts of exceptions to a search warrant, you'll learn. But one of them is this thing called exigency, alright? A cop is allowed to go into your bag when there's a risk that you're gonna pull a weapon out of it. Alright? They say the rules are this. You have a right to privacy. Okay? When is that right not really that important? When a guy can pull out a gun and kill a police officer. So boom, you can jump into the guy's bag without a search warrant if the police officer has a belief that his safety is in harm. Alright? The other real big exigency thing that cops often say is, I searched the bag because it was about to destroy the contraband. You know, swallow the drugs. Take it out and throw it, or something like that, alright? In this case, my guy got cuffed, he got put in the police car, and then they opened up the bag. Exigency in that case? No, right? He's in the car, so no safety issues, he's already cuffed in a car, the bag is closed, right? No issues of him picking that knife and throwing it in the sewer, because he's in the car. So we had a hearing, cop gets in there, testifies just how it is. I'm in there, cross-examining him. And as I get to the point, I said, so just so I'm clear, officer, you're telling me you handcuff him, right? And he goes, yes. And then you put him in the car, right? Yes. And then the bag is outside the car. He goes, yes. And I go, then you open it up. He goes, yes. And then you take out the knife, and that's when you find the knife. He goes, yes. I sat down. And I was like, what? Keep going. Talk more. I said, no, that's enough. That's the law. Got up in front of that judge. So, judge, here's the law. There's no exigency here. Tired of talking about the case and the facts. 2 days later, you got out. He was in jail for 6 months on this case. He had a knife on him, all right? Why did he have the knife? Turned out that he was doing some martial arts classes. And he actually had some nunchucks in there, too. And I don't know what he was doing with that knife. I don't know what he did with martial arts and all that kind of stuff. But it turns out that he spent 6 months in jail for this. And I got the case and said the law wasn't right. All right. Now, if that sort of doesn't resonate with you, if you're like, wow, great job, Adam, you just got this guy out who had a big machete in him, I would disagree with you. I'd say cops should have done it different. Cops should have done it differently. And the goal is to try to make sure that it is done differently. Because often, the guy doesn't actually have a machete, and often they just search your bag anyway, and I think there's something wrong with that. Some of the collateral issues that I deal with quickly, we'll go a little bit over, but quickly just to talk about some of the things that I do day to day with issues. DNA, there's some really cool issues now with DNA. They're asking clients to give a DNA swab when they get arrested for crimes that have nothing to do with DNA. Petty larceny, some criminal mischief cases, like when you throw a rock through a window, they're asking for your DNA now. Really cool, interesting issues there with whether or not it's a violation of your rights. It's probably not privilege against self-incrimination, right? Because it's about testimony for that. But you do have a right to not give up blood, typically, right? Or no? I mean, these are some interesting issues. So they passed, Governor Pataki, before he left, Pat wrote out these laws that says, here are the laws you got to give your DNA for. Right, so we're now in the appeals bureau. We're starting to collect cases where these are happening and trying to challenge this. Sex offender registry. They're now wanting sex offenders, and you may agree with this, sex offenders, certain types of sex offenders, to remain that for the rest of their lives. I think certain states, New York hasn't done it yet, certain states require you to have a certain color license plate. I don't remember what the color is. I don't know if you've read about this. But certain sex offenders actually have to have a certain color license plate so they can advertise to the community that they're a sex offender. I'm not sure how you feel about it, but I'll just tell you this much. I think it's terrible. I think it's terrible. Do I think it's terrible to be a sex offender? Absolutely. But I also think it's terrible that this guy has to put a certain color on his license plate. Post-9/11, a lot of immigration issues, deportation, I deal with a lot. I have clients who get arrested for really, really non-serious things. Immigration gets word that they are illegal, gone. They get deported back to their countries. Big issue right now in the presidential race is this immigration issue. We're at the forefront of that. Mental health, we deal with a lot. Last week I arraigned a guy by the name of Jason Arunga. He was on page 9 of the New York Post. New York Post is one of the two newspapers. He was on page 9, victim nails perv, subway flasher. This is my client. I arraigned him last Tuesday night. He had taken out his genitalia, and he had chased this woman around. And it was a terrible, terrible case. It's terrible. I mean, we laugh, it's terrible. He had taken out his penis, and he had ran around the subway, chased her from one subway car to the next. She then tried to get to switch subways, on the side kept going, chasing it. Terrible, right? She takes out her cell phone. Pretty actually smart of her. Goes, doop, takes a picture. Victim nails curve, subway flasher. There's a picture of him. There's a picture of him. On her cell phone, they put the New York Post, one of the biggest newspapers in New York, alright? I get him, the Post is there. They're in arraignments wanting to talk to the lawyer. I'm like, I can't talk to you guys. I go in the back and I go and talk to him. I'm thinking, wow, this guy's a perv, right? Perv! Go in the back and talk to him. Schizophrenia, bipolar. He's sick. He is real, real sick. He's a 24-year-old kid who lives on the subways, alright? He had no underwear on him. He had a big 6-inch hole in his crotch. I don't know what he was doing with it, but he was sick. Alright? We automatically judge. We automatically say, bad guy, deserves to go to jail. Alright? Public defender gets a different view of it. I see him as a sick, sick person. I had him evaluated by psychiatrists 2 days ago. They found him unfit to stand trial. That's the standard when you can get a case dismissed. He was found unfit. He was a sick, sick person. He's going to go to a hospital for about 4 or 5 months now. He's going to get a lot of help, a lot of medicine, a lot of counseling. And then they're going to dismiss his case. As a public defender, you're not always fighting cases and asking for, you know, truth and acquittals and all that. Sometimes you're just trying to help people who no one else is trying to help out. And it's a pretty powerful thing to be able to do that. So we work with a lot of mental health. That's a huge, huge thing, especially with purpose of using drugs. Do a lot of suicide. I had a client of mine 3 weeks ago who shot his head off. And I didn't see any of the tendencies associated with suicide. And I was like, wow, I should have caught that. I had him speak with a social worker because I saw there was some issues, but I never actually caught the suicide component of it. And so you deal with some powerful things with that. HIV, AIDS, public assistance in housing, school suspensions, DWI forfeitures where they take your car, you get arrested, they take your car. They take your car and you get arrested for DWI. Now some of you say, hey, that's a good thing, they shouldn't be driving and drinking. I don't know if you should be allowed to take your car. Probation, parole, it's a big, huge thing. Treatment program, Brooklyn is one of the pioneers of all criminal justice areas that does treatment. We deal with a lot of interesting things with treatment. Witness cooperation, I have my clients occasionally testify for the prosecutor. It's a tough one, but sometimes it actually helps them out. They get a better deal if they go help testify. Juvenile rights, we deal with a lot. I deal with a lot of grand jury practice things. I don't know if any of you know what a grand jury is, but in felony cases, in order for the prosecutor to keep the case going as a felony, they have to present the case to a grand jury. A grand jury is about a group of 20 to 25 people. They decide whether or not there's enough evidence to go forward. I put my guy into the grand jury sometimes. Sometimes I don't. Because if I put him in, it may lock him into a story. And if he doesn't win in the grand jury, if he doesn't blow it out, then we're stuck. And if we fight this case, I don't want to stick my guy in the grand jury and have him tell a story, and then be stuck to that story trial. Let's talk quickly, I know we're going way over, let's talk quickly about how you may want to seek out doing one of these type of gigs. And I really strongly encourage you to do so. Most jobs don't care that much about the grades. I know you're all caught up right now with just, you see those assignments, those first year assignments, I walk by that, I got nauseous to seeing it, and I'm not even in law school anymore. Read page 3 through 6 and then 9 through 10. You gotta do all this work now, alright? They don't care that much about grades. What they care about is some sort of commitment. Some commitment. So what can you do now? There's a legal aid in Charlottesville. Go volunteer. All right, maybe instead of going to softball one night, or maybe instead of going to a bar review or something like that, go volunteer, go watch a trial, go ask one of the lawyers here in Charlottesville if you can shadow them and see what it's like. All right, I guarantee you, you all are going to have these law firms knocking on your doors. If you want to go take these jobs, they're there for you. All right, go see what it's like to do something else. Go see what it's like to have power, to do good, to do something really, really interesting. Apply to both small and large cities. The bigger cities have the better public defense places. The number one shop in the country probably is D.C. The D.C. Public Defender's Office is the sharpest place in the country. The top people in the country come here. People who clerk for the Supreme Court then go back to the Public Defender's Office. So you can get a gig there. A lot of law firms now allow you to split summers. All right, they allow you to split summers. Go work half the time at the law firm, and then go work at the public defender's office somewhere. Some firms even pay you to be a summer associate, and then pay for the second half of the summer to go do something public interest. You know, they want to tout themselves as these, you know, we're connected with public interest. They will pay you to go do something like that. Go try it out. In school, definitely try out some clinics. I never did any clinics. You know, I'm not going to tell my client next week that I never did a clinic in law school. But I never did a clinic in law school. I would definitely try a defense or a prosecutor clinic. See what it's like. All right? See what it's like to try a case. We learn about law. We learn about all the things. See what it's like to actually practice it in a trial. Do some organizations. I don't think the Pro Bono Criminal Assistance Project is still around. But do some organization stuff. I think it's really fun to do. We used to answer prison letters. Prisoners used to write us here at the law school and say, hey, can you help with this case and that case? And every once in a while, we'd actually take a case. I think a few years back, we took a case to like the Fourth Circuit or something like that. It's really, like, really powerful things. The interviews are really interesting. They're not interviews like you normally do at a law firm where you just talk about yourself and you actually like do an arraignment, do a closing argument. They're going to make you do a bail application. It's really kind of fun to do. I never had any experience doing that. It took me 7 months to get an interview at Legal Aid in Brooklyn. Legal Aid is one of the other top shops. It's so huge. There's so many people. And basically, what you are is you're a private lawyer, but you're a private lawyer surrounded by other private lawyers, and you're surrounded by so much support, so much experience, and so much passion. And it was very, very hard for me to get this job. I thought going to UVA, I thought working at a big law firm, I didn't think it was going to be that hard. It was really tough. It's really tough to get it. So definitely try to get your hands into something soon. I know Dean Emery emailed me a little while back. I think you guys now they're encouraging you to do something during the winter breaks or something like that. I don't know. Something about volunteering in the wintertime when you're home. Take a couple hours a week and go down to your local district attorney's office and go see what it's like. You know, you may actually love it. All right? What things can I answer for you? I mean, I got to be some questions or anything like that. Thoughts? Go ahead.
What's it like when you first got started? Like, you're talking more about taking cases and stuff around, but what's it like, you know, day one walking and what kind of stuff do you have to
do? It's a sink or swim type of place. And it's a really, really steep learning curve. They don't put you in too tough. Basically, what you do in the beginning is shadowing. I follow around the lawyers for a long time. The hardest thing that I had to do when I got to Legal Aid was understand what the value of the case is. Because like all of you guys, I thought a bag of heroin meant jail. Right? It's like bartering. It's like, you know, fourth arrest, you already have a criminal record, two bags of crack equals, you know? It was just bartering. So it's understanding what a case was worth. So that was the hardest thing for me. They don't put you in too quickly. But at the same time, if you're a guy who's eager for experience, you can get it. I've tried two jury trials already in 2 years. I was a corporate lawyer for 2 years. I can tell you how many boxes I looked through. You know, I can tell you what I didn't do. But I've tried two jury trials already. I'm about to try my first felony trial. I've spent 9 years. It's Tuesday. That's in my first 2 years. So it's not scary. You guys are the smartest people around. You guys are achievers. It's not going to be scary. It's not going to be overwhelming. It's only going to be really, really neat. It's only going to be really, really neat. You're going to have a lot of opportunity. Yeah.
Well, I observed in your relationship with the DA, the bar, know your guys. not guilty. Can you say, you know, that's the way it's done? I know this guy's not guilty. This is it. It's got to go in exchange for, you know, going easier on him in another case. I mean, what is that process like?
Yeah, hopefully none of you guys have friends in like Brooklyn DA's office, but listen, deep down inside, I think the DA's are great. I'll tell you that much. If I had something happen to me, if I had someone commit some violence on me, if I had my bike stolen or something like that, I'd want the guy to be prosecuted too. They're just protecting us. And I think what they do is great. At times, do they get caught up in their power and sort of lose sight of what they're doing? Yeah. Day to day, I try to be nice to them. Some of them I really like. They're just like us. Some of them just couldn't get a job in late, so you know what? They went and went to the DA job. Right? They're just like us. They're anyone else. Day to day, I try to be as nice as possible. I think my boss did my first evaluation at Legal Aid. My first, like, 6 month evaluation, he wrote, he said, he's really smart, he works hard, he's really interested in all this kind of stuff, but he's a little too nice to the DA. but he thinks he knows too much. That was the other thing. He's a little too nice to the DA, and he thinks he knows too much. That I think I know too much thing. I think this comes across well with jurors. The jurors really resonate with experience. After my first jury trial, the jurors were like, wow, you've been doing this for a long time. I said, I've never tried this in my life. I have no idea. But the catching more bees with honey, I think it's important there, because they have a lot of power. And if they like you, if they think you're a good guy, you think you're a straight shooter, and I'm asking my guy, and I'm telling him, listen, my guy's an innocent here, man. Cut him a break. They'll say, you know what, Adam's a good guy, he's a straight shooter. Not on all my guys, I don't say my guy's innocent, cut him a break. You know? The other dynamic, it's actually probably more crucial than the DA dynamic, is the judge dynamic. You know? Some of these judges are weird. Are weird. Some of them are mean. Some of them are the sweetest, nicest people. You know? And that's a really important thing to do, is that how you contain your ego in that context. Because you really want to fight for your guy. You know? And you got to do it in a very effective way, because you see these people every day. I can't just start screaming at a judge one day and the next day come in and say, you know, listen, judge, you come, right? So it's a really important thing to try to be a nice guy, because I think you're going to get more done for your clients in that respect. What other things, especially for some of the first years? There's got to be some interesting things you're thinking about in terms of job options and things like that. What do you think? I mean, how many of you think that you'll go work at a law firm? Which is totally cool. I mean, that's what I did too. I mean, you guys just started. You maybe haven't even thought about it yet, right? Not even thought about it yet. Yeah. So keep a fresh option.
You were
straight
from thinking about it
till
December.
Oh, that's right. That's right. With the mountain, it would say December 1st. That's what I did. I sent out 180 letters my first year. And I got a job at Air Fox in D.C., and I worked at the big law firm in D.C., and then I went to New York the second summer. I encourage you to try law firm work. You may love it. But based on what I see when I talk to Courtney, when I talk to Jason, who's in admissions now, I talk to Gary, I talk to all my buddies. I had three guys that I was really, really tight with in law school. Brandon, Craig, and Dave. Craig quit after 2 years at Skadden in New York, which is like the top shop, and he now works in finance. All right. Dave quit after 8 months of a big firm in New York, and opened a pizza shop on the Lower East Side. Brendan is the only one who's still working at Austin Burger. He's married and he has a house. You know, one of the things that I got lucky with is that I didn't have any of these attachments. I wasn't married. I didn't have a house. So I could leave a job that was paying me 180 grand bonus to a job that was paying me 50 for the experience. And I'll tell you this, you can make a lot of money doing this type of stuff too. Because you're learning such a valuable craft so early on that you're so marketable. You're so marketable. These guys who are criminal defense attorneys who work at Legal Aid, a lot of them do it for 5 years, and then they go become a private attorney. You know how much people pay to be defended who have money? A lot of money. These cases that I do day in and day out where I just take pleas cost $3,000 a case. Right now, how many cases do you think I have in my file? Yeah, I have about 120 cases. Money, if you wanted to make it. What I realized early on in my life sort of choices is that
If you love what you do, it makes you a lot easier, and you can make a lot of money in anything. You guys are the most talented people, you know, in the country. You can do anything you want. Why not do something that's really cool and interesting? Why not at least try it, you know? So maybe try to offer money back for a little while if you don't like it. Consider something like this. Consider being a prosecutor. Consider being a public defender. It may be the most worthwhile thing you've ever done in your entire life. You know, and I never had thought about that before for this now. So I think it's really great that you're doing this type of stuff, you know, to consider. You know, if you want to talk to me after, I'll give you my contact information. I can try to hook you guys up with something up in New York. But anyway, consider it. Consider doing it. You know, it's not just a short-term thing. It's a long-term thing. You know, and I think you guys will really like it. So thanks for having me. It's really good to be back.